CliffCentral.com.
Chris Bishop is the managing editor of Forbes Africa, a publication which he's just told me is how many years old now?
Well, we started the project 5 years ago this week.
Right. Well, congratulations are then in order.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think, and also your circulation figures, unlike so many magazines, on their way up, which is terrific.
Going up. I mean, last year we had a survey by Ipsos, which was done independent of us, and they said we're the biggest read amongst the affluent business magazine in the continent. They reckon there's something like 200,000 people between here and West and East who read it every month. And circulation-wise, we started out very low, about 11, 12,000. We went up, we stuck about 17 for a while, and the first quarter of this year is 23,000, which, compared to our competitors, I know they're weekly, but it's quite a lot more than them. And if we don't do 30,000 in the next year, I'll be very upset.
Well, it's what we're doing here, you know. Instead of counting the people you reach the people who count.
Exactly. Yeah. And starting from scratch, same as you. Exactly, yeah. The same as you.
Well, here we are. I mean, you've got a very interesting past in journalism, first of all, and in having covered a lot of really interesting things here in Africa. But, you know, it also obviously paying attention to the whole world, because the world is so interdependent and so collaborative now on so many fronts. What is, do you think, particularly for a publication like Forbes, what is the main thrust of this? Is it giving people information, useful analysis of what is essentially becoming a world of big data, where it's very hard to find what the real story is in the numbers?
I think what we're giving here with this magazine, and the reason why I think people are buying it, is because when we launched just under about 4.5 years ago, the speech I made that night, I said I thought business was the new rock and roll of Africa. I think everyone's talking about it. And interestingly enough, I've been working on this continent for 22 years. When I first came, it was all about wars, it was about upheaval, it was about post-colonial politics, it was a lot of that sort of stuff. But now, if you look at it, a lot more people are realizing that if they want to improve their lives, they can't sit around and wait for government. Government yeah. coffers are emptying. It's over. And they've got to do something for themselves. They've got to pick up their own lives and move on. And I think what we give is, we do give information. If you notice, we run quite a big investment guide. We run roundup of all the markets, all the launches, all the IPOs across Africa every month. Essentially, what we do is give people information, which is part of the Forbes ethos. And by the way, I'll tell you a bit more. Forbes does have roots in Africa long before we were around. I can tell you that, but I'll tell you just now.
Okay.
But essentially, the Forbes ethos is to give people a takeaway, is that people pick it up, mm-hmm. they read it, and say, okay, great, and make a decision. I mean, the number of people have written to me and say, listen, I was about to toss my business up, and I read one of your stories in the mag, and I thought, no, okay, give it a second go. You know those cash wow. machines in the petrol stations, the Cash Express?
Right.
That was created by a guy from South Africa. He read Forbes in the States about someone doing it over there. He flew to the States, bought the technology, came back, and made a fortune.
And that's probably where most people draw their money now.
Exactly, exactly. Incredible. So we do make a change in a lot of people's lives. We do get a lot of people thinking about what they're doing. And also we promote this idea of entrepreneurship. I mean, you know, our covers, which are famous, have to be someone that you can look up to, someone of substance, someone who can actually say, okay, that's where I want to be in 10, 20 years' time. That's the message we get from everybody.
Extraordinary. It's also very much a... It's one of those aspirational things, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And in Africa, more than almost anywhere else, people are looking, because rich these days means you have options. Rich these days means you can be a global citizen. And rich these days in Africa means that you can put things back into the soil, into the people, into the places that you grew up in. If you've been a success, you can spread that success around.
Well, that's one of the things we do. We do a lot of stuff about social entrepreneurs, about philanthropy of a lot of the people who have made it. A lot of people pour a lot of money in very quietly. I mean, even Aliko Dangote, the richest man on the continent.
Yep.
And there was a disaster a year back. He gave a lot of money to help flood victims. He lends a lot of money to people who are trying to make it in entrepreneurism. He reckons that it's the salvation of this continent, and he thinks that the Nigerians are in the forefront of it. He says that they're across the world doing all kinds of things. One of his favorite stories, he went to Rio on a business trip and he needed a razor or something, goes out to the nearest corner shop, and it was run by a Nigerian.
Oh, really?
So he says, we're everywhere, we are entrepreneurs, we don't work for other people. And I think perhaps he's got a point. I mean,
well, there's something to be said for that Nigerian ethos, right? And yeah. and it is a go-getter. If there's a pipe that needs fixing, if there's a floor that needs polishing, if there's a note that's torn and you need someone to glue it back together again, the Nigerian guy's right up front telling you he could do all of those things and more.
Exactly. And you talk to people. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Nigeria reporting up there. And a lot of guys, they say, yeah, I mean, we start our own business. We work for ourselves. I mean, one thing that's quite interesting you'll find is the idea of black empowerment. They don't seem to get it, you know, because they ask me, they say, what is this thing, you know, with this, you know, 50%, 26% ownership. And I explain to them, well, you know, about the past and long-term stability.
And they still shake their heads.
And they'll say, why? Why do you have to ask someone else for business when you start your own? So that's one reason why I do have faith in these guys, you know. But anyway.
Well, let's, first of all, one of the covers, since you mentioned covers, was our friend Spoo. DJ Spoo a while ago. It was very controversial. There was a lot of noise around it. When the dust settled, it wasn't a big deal at all.
Well, it wasn't the cover, you see. What happened, somebody, and I asked him personally, he said it wasn't him, it was one of his fans, put him on the cover, you see.
Photoshopped him.
So what happened was, I'll tell you the story behind the story. What happened was, a lot of people were SMSing me saying, what's going on? Why are you putting people who are not like billionaires on the cover now? And I saw this thing. And anyway, so our lawyers, they've got a duty to protect the brand, right, clearly. So, I mean, I tried to explain it to the guys when I was interviewed. If you put your face on a Coca-Cola can, you'll spend the rest of your life in court. They will take you for every cent you've got because that's how strongly they defend their brand. So we defended our brand. We wrote him, he got very angry, and we ended up in the boardroom with a big sit down with him and his cohorts. But one thing I'll say for him and his colleagues is that when they came in, I was expecting a punch up, you know, because it was pretty getting a bit unpleasant.
He's a good guy, though.
Yeah, but I mean, him and his mate, and they were so sort of humble and straightforward. And I said, look, mate, we didn't intend any of this, sorry, and we shook hands at the end, and that was the end.
Right.
So,
but could have been horrible about it too, you know.
No, I mean, some people were saying, no, you know, you guys must sue, but I mean, really, and I said at the time, you know, I mean, like, you've got a young, sort of emergent, struggling business type here, and sort of, what's the point in taking them to the cleaners, really?
Let's talk about our own economy for a second, because I know that we certainly don't want to turn this into a, you know, so how do we fix South Africa discussion, even though there are things that I think in your analysis of the continent and of everything that's going on around us in the global economy might be really useful, and you could be the arbiter of that. It is interesting to me that in South Africa, we're looking at very low growth at the moment. Mm. We're looking at these horrible unemployment figures from last week. And I just thought your take on this, and when you speak to important people like Christo Wiese is on the cover of this month's edition, what do they say about these things?
I think they say most of the people here in the know in business in this country say exactly the same thing. And I'd say, one, they want certainty, right? And they're saying what they want the government here to say, and governments across Africa where they do it, to say, okay, next 10 years, guys, this is your tax rate. This is how you can repatriate your profits if you need to. These are the regulations that are going to apply to you. And that's that, right? That's what they want. Secondly, they want certainty when it comes to regulation. They don't want rewrites of bills. They don't want sudden changes in policy. They want people to say, okay, we're in for the long term. And thirdly, I think that what a lot of people want, they want this country and other countries, but other countries are doing it in Africa, to throw open their doors a bit more. Because, I mean, some countries around the world, they'll say, okay, you can bring all your equipment in duty-free. Mm. You can bring your staff in. We'll arrange for them, your experts to come in. We'll do their immigration for them quickly.
And you don't just have to be a Gupta to get that stuff done.
Exactly. No, you don't, because a lot of countries around the world are crying out for investment. And even the World Economic Forum that's going on at the moment in Rwanda, very interesting. I mean, I've been going to Rwanda probably for about the last 10 years and watched it recover from the genocide. And stuff.
Recover and start to progress and excel.
And it's incredible. Yeah. I mean, you can start up a business in a matter of days there, number one. Number two, I even interviewed the finance minister last time I was there, Klaba Gatete. And he said to me, we want the guys to come in. We want them to come in and take over the economy. You know, we're government. We'll oversee it. But we want the guys to come in and take over and start doing things. And I said to him at the time, isn't there going to be a tipping point, though, where governments in Africa feel they're losing control and try and claw it back? And he goes, not really.
Good for him. That's visionary.
Good for him. Visionary. I mean, I hope long may it rain. I mean, again, it's very easy, much easier, as I was pointing out to someone else this morning, for a small economy like Rwanda to do this, because it's a lot smaller. It's a lot more. I mean, this talk about corruption that's going on at the moment at the World Economic Forum, Paul Kagame says, I'm against it, I'm against it. And it's true. It costs you investment. It costs you confidence. But again, it's easy. I mean, someone was telling me a story once years ago. I was up there doing a story, and they said there was some problem on the departments. So Kagame gets in his car, drives down to the place, calls up the guy concerned, and fired him on the spot in front of everybody. And drove off back to State House. But I mean, you can't really do that in South Africa or Nigeria or other countries that are bigger.
There's a temptation. I would love to see that happen.
Yeah,
a couple of people that need firing.
And it happened. And if you know the man, I mean, Kagame as well. I mean, like somebody told me the former, Kaburuka, the former head of the AFDB, he was the finance minister, one of the first finance ministers in post-genocide Rwanda. And he was working in New York at the World Bank. And Kagame was there on a visit. And he says to the big cheese, he says, "Oh, have you got any Rwandans here?" And they said, "Yeah, we think we got one." He said, "Great." Went down, sat down, excuse me. He said, "I want you to come back and build your country," etc. So Kaburuka tossed his job in and
went back
home. Yeah, but I mean, Who else would do that? But there's very much that kind of, in Rwanda, that kind of spirit where they've torn up the rule book was torn up for them by the turmoil the country's been through. And
they almost had a chance to start again.
Yeah. And I tell you what, if you'd been there 10 years ago, you wouldn't recognize the place now. I mean, everything was destroyed.
Apparently Kigali is something else.
Yeah, something else. It is. And again, you know, I remember meeting a guy from I think he's from the East Rand, I think, out there, building houses. Huh. He's an electrician. I said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And he said, no. He said, "I'm an electrician." I said, "Oh, haven't they gone?" He said, no, they're all gone. They're all wiped out. So they have to bring in us and we train guys and for the future. And that's it. So fascinating times.
Well, let's hope we never get to a point where we need a genocide in order to get our act together. But things have changed so much in the African economy. You've written a lot about oil and resources over the years. And that used to be the story, too, that this was the continent that everyone else had to buy their raw materials from, whether it was mined materials or things like oil that were, kind of drilled and dug up and piped from everywhere. Now it's changing quite a lot.
Well, I think it has to, because
those things are not going to last forever, first of all.
Not only
they're becoming more expensive to mine.
Secondly, I mean, look at oil for a start. I mean, Nigeria was the kingpin for so long. They're struggling now. The oil price has dropped, the whole economy.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
They just said yesterday that we're now the third biggest economy in Africa after Egypt and Nigeria. Well, Nigeria and Egypt. But with Nigeria and the oil problems that they're facing at the moment, and their own economy under such stress and duress, aren't we back up by one and Nigeria's down by two, just in terms of what oil's done to them?
Well,
am I being wishful?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a very difficult one. I'm looking for a
silver lining here. Come on, Chris.
I don't know. I mean, when they had that rebasing of the Nigerian economy and said it was the biggest, I mean, everyone up there, if you talk to people in Nigerian business, they'll say, yeah, on paper, but we still can't compare to what you guys have got in terms of infrastructure and in terms of, I mean, the whole point is the way I always say to people, and they say, "What's the economy like here?" I say, "Well, you could still build a car from scratch if you wanted to. If you had the money in the morning, you could go out and find all the parts and put it together, because we still make things here." I think the future of this continent and the future of this country, I think, is industrialization. People getting their hands dirty, actually making things, building things for export. That's the future. I think the commodities thing, I think you become a slave to prices. Two, I think it has too much reliance. It's almost too successful, if you know what I mean. Here's a case in point for you for Nigeria, is the fact that when they struck oil in the 60s and 70s, they stopped farming. They said, "Oh, okay, we can buy food in, fine." And now there's a big problem. There's shortages of food, it's expensive, and their oil dollars aren't going as far as they used to. So now the country's trying to get farmers back on the land, and it's difficult. You lost an entire
generation. How much do they produce a barrel of oil at?
Good question, actually. I think it's about 20, I think.
Because the Saudis will always be cheaper, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't base your economy on something where you're not the best or the cheapest at making it.
And there's myriad of problems as well. I mean, there's leakages. There's also, as you know, in the Niger Delta, there's like kind of
There's violence and
activist attacks, people asking for money, etc., etc. It's fraught with problems, but again, it just shows it's easy to go downhill and it's very difficult to come back up because, I mean, how long is it going to take them to grow food again? Mm. It's going to be generations.
Obviously, also with mining and things like that, you must have stories where, you know, you have to go deeper to get less, and the cost of labor is now much higher than it's ever been, rightfully so. But also, it's made the commodity price, and even though that's determined by the market, that much more difficult to get a margin off of.
Well, yeah. I mean, what they say every year at the mining endowment in Cape Town, and I can believe it, is that the easy dollars have gone. You know, I mean, the fact that you are paying more labor costs now, there's all this talk of mechanization, which in some ways would be a good thing, bring down costs, and it would perhaps ease some of the labor turmoil. But on the other hand, some of the mines are not built for it. They're not big enough. They're not designed for mechanization. It's quite difficult. And again, in some ways, commodities, I know the miners will jump on me for saying it, but some ways it's too easy when the prices are good. You can make a lot of money very quickly without actually having to change your business model very much. You can just dig the stuff out of the ground and export it. There's talk of beneficiation now. It's very, very trendy in government to talk about beneficiation, and we should be getting more money from. But again, it's easier said than done. I mean, you look at it, India has got the biggest jewelry operation on God's earth. They don't have any mines. We got the mines. We don't have any jewelry. And again, you can't just transplant generations of skill and knowledge in making jewelry and stuff like that.
So you're saying industrialization's the key?
I think so. I think so. I think that whatever, I mean, all this stuff about IT and a lot of the entrepreneurs we do are involved in online stuff. Well, even yourself. But I'm just saying, I think personally, until the day you can email a ton of coal to China, you're still going to need people who make things, still going to need people who can transport things for you. And I think that industrial making money has always been a bit sort of looked down upon. It's a bit sort of old school. But I think there's a whole continent crying out for manufactured goods,
absolutely,
which would be a lot cheaper from here.
And This is an unsaturated market for those things, for
exactly.
goods.
Exactly.
Whether it's electronics, which we're currently getting from the East, or whether it's, hardware, things that we need to dig holes and to build buildings. These are things we can build.
Exactly.
We can do ourselves.
Exactly. And I think that it's going to be very difficult. You're going to have to change the mindset. The banks are going to have to come along with it, etc. But I think that's one of the hopes of this continent, and the fact that people have this opportunity to get out and make things actually that mean something.
I want to go back into your past a little bit here, because you've got an interesting few stories there are a couple of stories always that make someone famous and that set the career on fire. And back in 88, you received some award for covering an attempted assassination on the Queen.
Yes.
Was that... Which assassination attempt was that? Because I don't remember the Queen. I mean, it was before my time of sentience, really.
But that was the question.
What was it?
Basically, she came to... it was a remarkable story. And I, like most stories in this life, I actually stumbled on it by mistake doing another story. What happened was... I'll tell you the story from start to finish. What happened was there was a bank robber who was on the run. I was working then in New Zealand, and in the South Island, it's very heavily bush, sort of remote area. And this guy had knocked over a few banks, and he was on the run, and he was armed. So we went down to cover the story. I was then the sort of crime reporter for one of the big papers there. And anyway, we got to the place, and admittedly, it was very small. It wasn't difficult to find them. We found the police sniper squad who were looking for him. So we went and talked to the guys and said, look, can we come with you on your hunt? For some reason, I don't even know why, they said, sure. I mean, these days it would never happen. They said, sure. But the only thing is, you've got to ride a horse, which I couldn't ride a horse for love nor money. So we went down, and we all got horses. Luckily, I had a very docile one. He was all right. And that was it. We're off into the bush looking for an armed man with a sniper rifle, which was a bit of a worry. So we went across the bush, we went to the rivers, and it was an incredible experience, you know. And
how long did this go on?
No, it went on for a few days. We'd get up in the morning, we go out, look for him. They'd be like, and it was almost one of those sort of stories that you tell your grandchildren. I mean, every now and again, the guys were like, and then hit the ground and, you know, take up sniper positions. And you think, oh, my God, all I've got is a notebook. I mean,
this must be the most dangerous man in New Zealand history.
He was, you see. But anyway, his name's shame. He's gone. His name was Christopher John Lewis. I'll never forget his name. But one thing I noticed when we were with them is that they were talking about this guy like he was like the day of the jackal. You know, he was like, they were talking about this guy like he was the most dangerous person on earth. I'm like, this is odd. This kid's like 19, 20. Why are these guys so scared of him, you know? So we started to dig into the past and the background of this guy, and there was quite a story there. I mean, the guy was like a bit of a nutter, shall we say, and he was one of these sort of neo-right extremists, and he grew up in a place called Dunedin, which is down
South Island.
In the south, yeah. And anyway, he had got it into his head that the Queen, i.e. the head of the Commonwealth, was a traitor. And, you know, he thought that she was betraying him and the cause. You know how these guys think. So he decided he was going to kill her during a royal visit to Dunedin. And it's just a bizarre story. So I went and we went away. We investigated. We talked to the investigating officers who arrested him at the time of the royal visit. And they, luckily for us, they'd left the police so they could talk. And they told us the whole story.
God, what a story.
So what happened was this kid was a crack shot. And he decided, he had this sniper rifle, he was going to go down. There's a place called the Octagon in Dunedin, like a big open plaza. And those days, security was a joke. You know, there was none. Mm-hmm. So he and his friend, who actually became a lawyer in later life, but he was obviously rebelling against his dad at the time. They worked out how long it was going to take him to get there. They found an office where some dad's office, they could get in there with their rifles. They worked out the field of fire, because they printed it in the paper where she was going to be at the time.
Right.
So they worked out the field of fire and how many seconds they'd have to blow her head off. She walked past. They're going to change history, mate. So anyway, so basically...
And of all places in New Zealand.
In New Zealand, yeah. And so the kid gets there. They got their bikes. And of course, no one checked them. No one. There was no shutdown and dogs in those days. The Queen was just roaming around. Everyone was waving flags, all that stuff. Anyway, so he gets on the roof above her and he was there, ready to pull the trigger.
Wow.
And luckily for her and for history, two policemen, uniform guys, got up on the roof to get a better view. Can you believe? And they blocked his shot. So this kid was fed up. So like, he pulled a shot in the air and everyone like, what was that? What was that? What was that?
Oh, God.
So, and then he went round another place to try and get her again, found out he couldn't get a field of fire, and fired another one. So these two shots went off. The whole crowd was saying, what was that? And of course the cops said, oh no, it was a construction site, a car backfiring. It was
but
nothing.
They were panicked.
Well, they didn't know what it was. And then my friend, the former detective, Tom Lewis, I'll never forget his name, he was working in Australia then, and so he could talk. So he came to me and he said, no, they picked him up for knocking over a post office. And what they were doing with him and his friend, who was also the lawyer now, they got the two of them together and separate, sorry. And they were trying to sort of like interrogate them. And they were trying this thing because they were young kids going, oh, you know, you guys are giving us so much trouble, you know, et cetera. Trying to, and the kid said, oh, well, that's not all I've done. So then they started spitting out this story. So then the other detective who was interviewing the other guy came and said, are you hearing this stuff? And he said, yeah, it's amazing. So they worked out that they could have knocked the Queen stone dead, you see. And he said to me, so then he contacted the bosses and they said like, shh, 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 because it would have been embarrassing. One, two, it probably would have ended royal tours for the decade. Three, they'd look like idiots. Four,
the Queen.
Was 2 seconds from having her head blown off. So they hushed it up and they said, don't talk to anybody about this. Leave it until I came along.
That must have gone everywhere, that
story. Yeah, it ran the world. I mean, it was on ITN. It was like Day of the Jackal shooting.
Did you get a letter from the palace saying thanks for letting us know?
No. The palace, you know, there was usual neither confirm nor deny stuff, but it went global. And and it was just a really incredible, bizarre story. But again, you know, it was the first time I was ever on a horse and it was weird. And the kid eventually, and the kid, they're still hunting in the bush like a week later for him. And what he did, he hung under a train and got out of the bush on the bottom of a train, got on the ferry somehow to the North Island, got a train the other way. There was this massive manhunt going for him. And eventually he was caught trying to buy a car.
Oh, wow.
At the other end in Auckland. It's an incredible story. And he gave a real person as his reference.
Oh.
So they phoned this woman up and said, oh, do you know this bloke, Chris Lewis? And they said, call the police. The news. You know what he looks like? Call the police. Wow. So anyway, he got nicked, and I think he got 5 years for armed robbery, you know, and that's what he got in the end. But as I say, he's late now, but it was just an incredible story, you know, and it just shows when you're covering stories, you'd always think out of the box.
I mean, in some way, you know, that could have been a Gavrilo Princip moment that was averted.
I mean, at the end of the day, everyone says, oh, yeah, but it wouldn't have happened. But you just don't know. I mean, how many people out there, kids, I mean, people.
How many assassination attempts have we seen since, you know, Reagan and all of those things that happened?
And those days, there was no security, basically. There's a few cops around. There was no people on roofs, talking up the sleeves, nothing. It could have happened. But, I mean, it's one of those.
And Chris, is an editor now, it must be fascinating for you to think back on your own stories of how you had a week on horseback with these guys. And they paid for you to do it.
Yeah, I know. Fantastic.
You wouldn't do that for any of your journalists. Now, if they said to you, I've got to go on a manhunt on horseback for a week, you'd say to them, I'm terribly sorry, the budget doesn't allow, right?
Exactly. Well, not just that. I mean, I honestly, I'll tell you what, it's July the 6th, it'll be 35 years since I started, right?
Wow.
Since I was a kid, you know? And I'll put it this way, I don't regret one day. I mean, the stuff that we've done there, I mean, even this continent, I mean, I've been to the war in Angola, I've seen uprisings in Zimbabwe, I've been to Mozambique, I've been in the landmine fields there. I've been in the Congo, been across this continent. I mean, one of the great jokes that we always have is with my staff is that they're all born and bred here,
right,
in Africa, and I was born elsewhere. But I've been everywhere, and they've been nowhere. So, I mean,
yeah, it is a thing that I find very bizarre about South Africans. We don't know this continent as well as we should. Other people from the rest of Africa know us terribly well, but not vice versa.
Well, I think it's almost like almost like an America thing a little bit, you know.
Bit of a superiority complex.
They call us here the Yanks of Africa. And I think there's something in that, and the fact that we think, oh, well, you know, well, everything's here that needs to be here. But actually, when you go, one thing that I must have toured this continent like 5-6 years, long time. And I always tell the guys, not 5 weeks, not 5 months, 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, moving all around the place. And it's amazing what's out there that we don't know about. It's amazing the businesses. It's amazing the activity that's going on the continent. And we never know about it because it's sort of off the radar for us. But I think it's a massive amount of potential there, business-wise. And I think that the sooner the continent wakes up to it, the better, I think.
You've also written about Africa's oil story, the crude continent. You had an interview with Nelson Mandela and several other documentaries around him as well, which are interesting to reflect on. How do you feel about all this revisionist history that's going on around Mandela at the moment?
Yeah, I don't know. I knew him pretty well because at the time when he was head of state, I was working for the SABC then. So we were with him on the road. So we knew him quite well. You know, he was just like one-to-one. I don't know. I mean, I think he was an incredible person. I mean, he always remembered what you talked about. I mean, how many people did he meet? He always used to ask you questions. I remember that we'd be at press conferences with Mugabe in Harare, and they had to put your hand up and say who you are. And I'd be like, oh, Chris Bishop is there. And he'd say, oh, Mr. Bishop, how are you? How are you doing? Are you enjoying yourself here? And all that stuff. It was good that way. I remember one time I'd crippled myself playing football. And I was just on the eve of the OAU, or the African Union as it's now, in conference. Oh, I was in never so much pain. And I had ruptured my knee ligaments fairly badly. So anyway, so I was like hobbling through the conference. And we saw him. And of course, as the national broadcaster, we had first bite at him. And I said, look, you know, would you do an interview? And he said, oh, of course. Come, let's go. And so he starts walking off, you know, the way he used to walk. And then he sees me not with him. And he suddenly realizes that there's somebody slower than him on the play, especially somebody as young as I was then. So anyway, so I'm hobbling behind, holding my knee. I'm in agony. And he turns around and he goes, Mr. Bishop, what's wrong with you? And I said, no, I did my knee playing football yesterday. And he goes, then may I suggest you take up boxing? It was cool, but this revisionist history, I mean, the whole point is about the old man. If you knew him, he wasn't a saint. He never wanted to be a saint.
He never wanted anyone to think of him that way either, right?
And he wasn't an angel either. Everybody knows that. But he was, I think the only thing is that he ever suffered from is that he thought there was good in everybody. No matter, I mean, I always used to wonder, you know, if he'd have met some of the great sort of dictators of this earth, how we would have regarded them.
Well, he met with someone like Gaddafi and treated him as an equal.
Exactly.
And, I mean, to his credit, he was one of the few people in the world who could, and who could have, you know, at his inauguration, all of those varying people who would never have crossed lines to meet each other before, and they suddenly found themselves sitting a few seats away from Arafat and Gaddafi. And
And again, you know, at the end of the day, we can all, as journalists, we can all sort of cast our eyes at things like, you know, sitting down and breaking bread with Gaddafi after all the stuff that's come out about him post his death. But
yeah,
on the other hand, isn't that something great in the fact you can sit down and, as they say, what is it, hold a candle to the devil and say, look, you know, explain yourself and talk and see some good in somebody, you know?
Now, speaking of these dictators and great, you know, sort of, well, let's say people who've had a huge effect on history. Have you had an interview or a discussion with Robert Mugabe before?
Yes, he was one of the first people I interviewed when I came to this continent in 1994.
And tell me how that went. Yeah. What's it like? I've heard fascinating stories about this.
He's a very strange guy. I mean, obviously, he's getting a bit frail now, but I met him when he was in his pomp, I think. I mean, one thing about him, always impeccably dressed. Expensive suit.
Very well-mannered, impeccably dressed, yeah. Supremely well-educated. And a stickler for certain very European traditions.
No small talk. It was one of his favorites. He used to do that thing, I don't even know what you call it, the psychologists call it, you know, where you don't talk to people and you kind of have this power game with them. So you talk to him and he'd be like, just look you in the face and say nothing. And he'd say something else and...
You'd keep talking and
he'd
just look
at you. Yeah, and he would just say nothing, you know? He was very schoolmasterly. Well, that's what he was. He used to tell you, when you presented him with evidence, yeah. He used to say, oh, who told you that? What do you mean, who told you that? It's fact. And they said, no. You just don't want to believe these opposition papers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He was always very
dismissive.
Glib and dismissive of anybody who criticized him. He was very well, incredibly well-spoken. And this was in the early days. He took things quite seriously. But during the time I was working in Harare, it was about, as I say, about 5-6 years, you could see then that he was slowly... I mean, I was there with that famous thing about rant about the gays. In fact, we covered that whole thing, and it was actually bizarre, you know? I mean, and he was sharp then. He was very sharp with the media. I mean, for instance, I remember one time we had this call that he was making a speech to the Women's League. ZANU-PF Women's League, yes. In the middle of Samora Machel, if you know Harare.
Right.
It's like a massive concourse. And I thought, can't be. So we got the crew and we went shooting down there. And there he was in the middle of a 1,000 people standing on a chair virtually making this speech. So I thought, okay. And it was about gays. So he... So anyway, so we got
what
the
a strange preoccupation.
It's weird, yeah. We always found that. I mean, I covered that story from start to finish. And I thought it was very weird because... I don't understand why.
Not as if the gays had mounted any major opposition to him. It's not as if anyone around him is particularly obviously gay. And I don't understand why anyone in such a situation would be so hugely prejudiced against some group.
Maybe at the time, the bad times are starting to bite a bit.
So he needed a scapegoat, maybe.
Right. Maybe. And he knew as well that at the time, black, white, brown, whatever.
Right.
A lot of people there, it's very much a taboo subject, and a lot of people would agree with him, etc. But I remember this day, so we got the camera out, and he caught us in the corner of his eye, and he was speaking in Shona, you know, to the women, like, lambasting. And then he kept looking, and the cameraman was there. I can still see him now. He's like this Israeli guy. He was like looking down his thing, switching the camera on, and you could see just checking out the corner of the eye. And he saw, as soon as he put his eye to the eyepiece, he knew that we were turning over. And then he switches straight into English like that. And he goes,
wow.
Gays, let them be gay in Europe. Let them be gay in America. There will be sad people here, like in English. So he knew that we were going to get it, which we did, you know. So
wow.
Very sharp. But I mean, I was there, like, and I asked him straight. I said, well, what's your problem? And he said, his answer was, I'll never forget it. He said, I don't think that men should give birth using wombs. Which was an odd one for me. But the whole thing was strange. I mean, really. And actually, one of the sad things for me at the time as a journalist, it was a great story. Everyone was chuckling about it. But it's kind of deflected from some of the more serious stuff that was going on at the time, economic stuff that was falling apart. So in his latter time, he was very angry. He got angrier as the years went on. He was into cricket and things. I mean, I never really understood that. I mean, I was there once. We were watching Zimbabwe play cricket. And he said, and he was talking to this guy called Peter Chingoko, who was the head of the union. And he said, oh, so do these guys, do they get paid? And Chingoko says, well, yes. I mean, cricket's a very lucrative professional sport. And he goes, oh, really? Oh, I thought these boys did it for free.
So a little disconnected.
He was very up there. He was very sort of, you know, aloof. And when he used to walk into a room, I always used to think it was like he used to be turned cold, you know, like, ugh. He was never a warm guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Madiba, you hail him across the street and he'd wave. But I mean, Mugabe, never, never, never like that at all.
And our other famous president who succeeded Mandela is Thabo Mbeki, who was also quite cold
cold, very cold. He used to always say, pipe tobacco, mate. You could smell it from like 10 Ks away. But he was very cold and he used to shake your hand. Like it was almost like when he shook your hand, he was almost telling you to get lost. You know, and I'd see him in studios, we'd interview him.
Yeah.
And one thing I always remember was I went to the opening of the Mandela Bridge down in town.
Yeah.
And he was opening it there and he came. It was a rotten day anyway. It was a bit rainy and stuff and there was a lot of people there. And he came and this car jumped out, shook hands with a couple of people and jumped in his car and drove off. And there was this old sort of ANC guy next to me and he said, you know what? If the old man was here, the place would be rocking. And I thought, yeah.
Well, the guy who came after him would have made the place rock as well.
Yes, yes.
If charismatic, yeah. Jacob Zuma.
I was there at the opening of the government mining company, which I don't think has gone very well.
I don't even know that it still exists, does it?
I will never forget to this day is that he did a speech in two languages, in Zulu and English. And English was, we are welcoming foreign investors to our country. And Zulu was like, hey, we're rich. We've got wealth under our ground. Do you want to go and buy good clothes and get ready to be rich? Because this is our wealth and we're going to take it. And the whole room was erupting. And luckily the Zion man spoke Zulu and I said, translate. And we were going through and he was doing a two-tone speech, complete. What people wanted to hear in English and then what people really wanted to hear in Zulu. And I thought at the time, oh, this guy is clever. When it comes to dealing with people, no two ways
Wily.
About it. Yeah, straight
out about that. I'm fascinated with the. I had Alistair Sparks in here the other day, and you know, the long lens of history gives you a much better feel for context. Mm-hmm. We overreact to the immediate, and we think that we're in the worst possible place right now. How do you think the whole media business has changed? Having been in print, having been in television, having done all of this stuff, and seeing it now over. You said 35 years since you were on that horse chasing a...
On the horse, it was only 20.
Okay, 35 years of career.
Journalism, yeah. No, I started on a weekly newspaper, a small one, you know, where people used to buy it on market day every Thursday. Everyone would read everything, all the deaths and births. Every time you put a word out of place, the guys would be in like legions of people pointing fingers at you, berating you for ruining their heritage. You know, that's where I started. And yeah, it was hectic. Funny enough, I always thought about it. I got more trouble in my first job as a junior on a circulation of 13,000 copies a week than I've ever had working for the BBC, say, where people were like millions watching, or even the SABC, where we had like millions watching around the continent. In fact, the SABC was one of the best times. I mean, we were in Harare at the bus station. I'd be going to buy something, walking through, and some guy would come through the crowd, Chris Bishop.
Right.
Thank you. They're telling me what's going on in my country. I mean, I just don't. We know nothing from reading the. Well, those days there was no internet.
No,
we can't find out what's going on. Thanks for telling us. You know, so I don't know. Sometimes it excites me. Here, I think that this country should leave the press freedom situation well alone. I don't think it does anybody any good. I don't think it does business any good. I don't think it does the people any good. And I think you can only fool the people for so long. I mean, I remember in Zim, they used to have blackouts on big stories, i.e. They used to, when there was a riot on or something, they'd say, right, nothing on TV, nothing on radio. And in the papers, we'll give it two paragraphs next day to say there was a few street kids causing trouble.
Right.
And I've been in that capital city and the place was burning, People were like wrecking the place. People were berating the government, fighting with the police, getting tear gassed, chucking bottles. I mean, I remember one time this guy, we were at a petrol station. The guys looted it and smashed the place up. And the guy got a petrol Bowser and a Zippo lighter.
Oh, God.
Flicked the light, put the petrol on. Thank God the force of the petrol knocked the light out otherwise. I mean, we were diving for the floor. You'd have heard it in Joburg if it had gone up. There was all this stuff going on. And the next day, the government say, oh, there's a minority, a few hundred street children causing trouble. And people used to pass the paper around and laugh and say, these guys, where do they live? You know, they think we're going to believe this nonsense. And people will always sniff you out in the end.
And I don't think you can shut that conversation up anymore. Now that the internet and mobile phones are ubiquitous and everybody's on, and, you know, even people in the middle of the Congo jungle can access information at the touch of a button.
Exactly. I mean, the other day I was at a party. I mean, there was we have an app on Magster. It's something called Magster, and the guy I was talking to, I said, how'd you get this thing online, this magazine? I said, oh, it's on Magster. And he goes, oh, really? And he pushes, he goes, I've got it.
Yeah, just like that.
10 seconds.
Right.
And I thought, that's where we're going. And I don't think the governments can stop it. I don't think so. And I think if they shut down, if governments try to shut down the internet, people will come up with an alternative.
Well, we saw when they tried to switch off the signal in Parliament what outcry there was.
And what I'll never understand, as far as long as I live, about liberation movements, and I've dealt with a dozen between here and the Sudan, is that these, for them, publicity and free press was their oxygen when they were coming up. I mean, everyone. I mean, for instance, talking about Mbeki as we were, I mean, the guys used to tell me in the old days when they used to see him and interview him, they'd be, hey, lads, you got any cigarettes? You got any, like, Camel or anything? Because you couldn't get cigarettes
right in
some of the camps they were in. So, I mean, and these guys were interviewed. They were all over the place. And again, and now people, the same people in power, they're saying, no, no, we don't want free press. We think it's irresponsible. We think you're bringing a country
down.
Yeah,
but you know, they say, what's that old quote? I think it was Chesterton. On the eve of the revolution, the greatest leftist becomes a conservative.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, I hope, I mean, I really, when they were talking about the security bill here a few years ago, I thought, oh, here we go. But I think, no, I mean, it's still reasonably free here. And I don't think people realize how free it is. I mean, people used to say,
Freedom House came out with a report just last week, which they released about media freedom here. And we're regarded as a safe zone.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, no. And I think the more we push it, the more, like, you know, there's new stations and new sources like you. And the more we push it, the better. I mean, for instance, I mean, the guys used to make me laugh here, you know, from Joburg when I was in, like, say, Zambia. They say, oh, yeah, Chris, can you get a soundbite with Chalupa this afternoon? So you nuts.
What?
Oh, yeah. No, but just go and get him. I said, what? One time I said, okay, let me go. So I went to State House. We sat in his waiting room for about 2-3 hours. The guy said, oh, no, he's coming. Don't worry, he's coming.
No, never came.
Never came. Because there's just not that culture.
At least give you tea.
I couldn't believe when I came to work in this country from working up there,
was
that you could phone up the MEC or the Premier and he'll say, I'll meet you on the steps, 10 minutes, let's
Absolutely.
Go. And I think that's precious. Precious.
And there are still people who will do it. I actually think that there are many more than people think.
I mean, the other day, we were talking about Thuli Madonsela. Obviously, it's a big story right now. And so there's a lot of guys from Zimbabwe and further afield who work in our organization. And one of the guys turned to me and said, you know what, Chris, this lady would be at the bottom of the lake if she was working further north.
And it is an outrage that we saw in Sunday's papers just a couple of days ago that, you know, that there are people who were actively plotting to kill her.
No, I know. I mean, like, nonsense.
Outrageous.
Just nonsense, you know. And again, you know, I mean, you know, you're in the media as well. I mean, some of the things people have written about me down the years, and probably you, appalling. You know, just like vicious. They don't even phone you up for a response.
Yeah, they don't.
I think, well,
And when you ask them why they didn't call you, they didn't even have your number.
I mean,
couldn't
rubbish.
Have been bothered.
In fact, the only time, and you'll smile at this one, the only time ever there was some complete nonsense story about me at the SABC, and the guy actually phoned me up. I mean, it was completely untrue. And I said it's untrue, and he said, okay, fine, thanks.
That was it.
The story, yeah.
If only it was always that easy. God. You've been to every continent.
Yep, for us 30. I was lucky.
Antarctica too?
No. South America?
Yeah, you see. That's always the one that trips people
up. Yeah, exactly. Actually, I should change that.
Every but one. But
every,
I mean, there's
but
nothing
one,
going on there anyway.
Luckily, Australasia, Asia,
putting a report on
South
penguins.
America. Yeah. But so, no, I was lucky. Yeah, very lucky.
And you must have met some really incredible people during this time. Those are always the most exciting stories, because I imagine if you have people around for dinner,
yeah,
there are probably a thousand stories you still haven't told.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's odd how you bump, especially this continent. I remember once going to cover a conference of opposition leaders in Africa, in Gaborone, in Botswana, and it was actually quite weird because you got all these losers of elections across the continent, all moaning, complaining.
And such an incredible opportunity for all the dictators to just bum the hell out of them and they'll never be back.
So anyway, there was this guy, big, tall guy, like imposing guy from Ghana called John, you know, and we just say, hey, John, we used to have a drink in the evening, there's a chat. Anyway, so the last day we were there, they wanted one more interview. They said, oh, can we have somebody from West? I think it was for SABC Africa in those days. So anyway, I saw John walking across the... I said, hey, John, don't go yet. Can we do an interview? And he goes, sure. So he goes in his room. And his room, I'm not kidding you, was like 6 foot square. It was the size of this, you know, you could touch the bathroom from the bed. So he sits down. I said, can you give us your name, please, and title? And he goes, okay, my name's John Kufuor. I'm going to be the next president of Ghana.
My God.
And we looked at each other like...
This is the guy you've been drinking with.
Yeah. And I said, what? And he goes, no, absolutely. Blow me down. 2 weeks later, there he was. And he's like,
that's incredible.
I mean, I've Savimbi. Yeah. I can tell you, he used to have a handshake, crush your bones, you know, without even trying. I've met Kaunda. I've been out walking.
Ever meet Idi Amin?
No, he's long before my time. Yeah. I'm not quite that old.
Well, you're going to take a chance.
No, I know. But Museveni.
Museveni,
I met him.
You can explain that very strange thing that's happening in East Africa and Southern Sudan about hats, different hats that leaders are. They've got their signature hat.
I thought about that with Museveni when I met him. He's just very, very bald.
I think
he must get terrible blisters on his head. I don't know. He's a funny guy, and he's a very funny guy. I mean, I remember once I was at some do with him, and he said, "What is it? We're talking about business." And government staying out of business.
Oh.
He said, no, I think it's a good idea. He said, but on the other hand, he said, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is to get government out of business. And anyway, and then he tells us another one about
biblical.
How the UN had built him a road through the middle of Uganda, which he said, looked nice. He said, but how long is it going to last? They said, oh, well, the ones we build in Europe last about 30 years, but this one will last you about 5. And he goes, oh, well, can you bring a European road here for me and they can have this one? He's a very funny guy. I mean, when I saw him, he was dealing with some issue in his state house, and he goes, listen, I'm a warlord here, so what I say goes, all right.
He said that. That's fantastic.
Laughing, yeah.
Well, listen, congratulations with all the 5 years of success here at Forbes Africa. I hope that the circulation continues to grow and that people far and wide can read electronically as well as in print form.
They do around the world, a lot of people.
And keep on doing the good work and fighting the good fight.
Okay.
There's always going to be a space for great journalism, right? Doesn't
Absolutely.
Matter what the format is.
No, I think so. And I think people want to know. I think people want to know. People want to hear from the big shots. I think people want to know what's happening on the ground always.
And your whole family are all journalists,
aren't they? My father's a journalist. He's still working, aged 81.
Really?
My wife's a journalist. My sister's a journalist.
God.
In fact, actually, my father, I mean, where I came from in Worcestershire, he was quite well known. You know, wherever he went, everybody knew him. And my sister, she followed him before me. And she, when we went to the exams, our qualifying exams, she got the top mark in the entire country. Like, she couldn't just do well. And anyway, everyone used to say when I came along, they said, oh, you know, you got a big act to follow, hard luck. And my father, a year or two back, I was visiting him, and he saying goodbye to me on the train station. And he says, you know what? He says, everyone used to say you had a hard act to follow. He says, you know what? I think you've outdone us both. And walked off. Whoa.
That's quite something, huh?
I don't care how many awards I get. That's worth more than anything.
Well, what a way to end this discussion. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Chris Bishop, Forbes Africa. CliffCentral.com.